It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll wrap up our Literacy in Wisconsin series with a look at tutoring efforts here in our state.
But first, it's time for our weekly review of state news, the Wisconsin News Roundup.
And it's been a big week for state politics. We'll get the latest on bills in the legislature and talk about the primary election that took place this week.
And Latinos and supporters from around Wisconsin rallied in Madison this week to oppose immigration bills currently in the works.
For more on those stories, we're joined by Robert Mentzer, storytelling editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, it is great to be back.
Well, we'll touch briefly on the Wisconsin legislature before moving on to some of those other stories we mentioned. One big thing that looks to be going nowhere is something that deals with water rights in the state. What are the details there?
Yeah, so this is one of the flashpoint bills, one of a bunch, really, and some of them have passed, some of them are now law. But this water privatization bill is one that we learned this week will not get a vote in the Senate. At least that's what was reported. The bill would have essentially made it easier for governments to privatize their local water supply. It seems to have come about because a Pennsylvania company called Aqua America Incorporated, which owns water utilities in 8 states, apparently wanted to expand into Wisconsin, and some legislators thought that they should make that a little easier to do. Although the company said and the sponsors say that there weren't like specific places where they were planning to expand, but anyway, if the company did have plans to expand to Wisconsin, they're not going to get to because it sounds like the Senate isn't going to vote on this. Or if they do, they'll have to sort of go through what they have called sort of a cumbersome referendum process and so on.
We'll hear more about water legislation and some other the action in the Assembly and the Senate yesterday from our own Sean Johnson coming up after 5. So in other state political news this week, Senator Ron Johnson and his opponent, former Senator Russ Feingold, took sides on whether President Obama should nominate a new Supreme Court justice after the passing of Antonin Scalia. So what are we seeing in this outside of the presidential race? This is the big story in Wisconsin for the fall.
Absolutely right. And you will never guess what their positions are. Actually, you might guess. Feingold is in favor of Obama putting a nominee forward. Johnson is against. Johnson is in line with the Republican orthox view that they're not going to hear any nominee from this president. So that is, I mean, the both sides are pretty dug in on their political positions. It's not really shocking that those are the views that a Democrat and a Republican would hold. But what we've seen is, because this Senate race is a key one that could very well play a role in deciding control of the U.S. Senate, it's already started that there are outside groups, really on both sides, spending money on these campaigns, either on the liberal side, asking people to call Senator Johnson and tell him he should have allow a vote or allow hearings on an Obama nominee, and on the conservative side, a group called the Judicial Crisis Network. It was reported that they're going to spend more than $1 million on ads in several states, actually, to thank Senator Johnson for letting the people decide, meaning blocking any nominee until after the presidential election.
Hey, no surprise the positions Feingold and Johnson took. No surprise that they're taking a position. No surprise that outside groups are going to make a big deal about this. Are voters going to care? Is this something that is going to be a voting issue when it comes November?
Man, it's big, you know. It feels like usually you can't go wrong saying that that people don't really vote on Supreme Court politics, but this is as big as it gets, you know. And especially depending on how the nomination plays out, I think it's very likely that people will care a lot about this issue this year.
Talking to Rob Mentzer with USA Today Network Wisconsin about some of the big news from around Wisconsin over the last week. We'll stay with elections. One coming a little closer up here, Rob. There was a primary election this week for the state Supreme Court, looking ahead to an April election. Sum that up for us.
Sure. So this was a statewide primary election for Supreme Court. The nominee or the candidates were Justice Rebecca Bradley, who is a Walker appointee, just appointed in the last few months to the court, and widely understood to be a very conservative justice, sort of a conservative movement person. The other two nominees were Judge Joanne Kloppenburg, who also ran in 2011 against conservative Justice David Prosser. Is understood to be a liberal justice, and Judge Joe Donald, who is an African-American Milwaukee County Circuit Court judge. Bradley came out on top. She got 45% of the vote. Kloppenburg got about 43%, and Donald a distant third with about 12. So the way that liberals, people who are inclined towards the left side of things, interpret this result is that essentially what they see is that the anti-Bradley vote was bigger than the pro-Bradley vote. That they assume that anyone who voted for Joe Donald will vote for Kloppenburg in April. So that is the way that the tea leaves are being read. I expect that this will be another one that we are likely to see sort of gross outside spending and attack ads on, but for sure it was. I talked to a lot of Democrats this week who were very excited about that outcome.
Yeah, you mentioned the turnout. How did this isn't fall level turnout? This isn't going to be presidential election turnout, but in the world of primary Supreme Court elections, how do we do?
I mean, you're looking at a little more than 500,000 people in the state voting, right? It's a very low turnout election. This was the only statewide primary election. Like, we here in Wausau were voting in a mayoral primary, but even that, it didn't exactly have lines out the door. So the spring elections generally are quite low turnout as well, but it's different this year because there's this other race going on that's a little higher profile for president. So the April 5th election will also be a presidential primary. In general terms, I think that the spring primary electorate tends to be a bit older and probably a bit more conservative. So this is another reason why there are a lot of liberals seeing this as a good sign for Kloppenburg in April. But you know what? There's going to be a lot of people turning out for the Republican primary as well. So I guess it's certainly going to be a battle.
Yeah, there's not a lot of precedent to draw from in that conjunction of the primaries and this very partisan, nonpartisan judicial race. Well, I want to move on to one more story. Yesterday, the big rally at the state capitol, A Day Without Latinos. Talk us through what we saw, what the impact might be.
So we saw more than 20,000 people in Madison sort of bust in and traveling from all over the state for this rally, A Day Without Latinos, the idea being to draw attention to the economic impact and the political power of Latinos in the state. The rally was organized around a few pieces of legislation that are under consideration in Madison. One of those, one of the bills that was being protested, which would have banned so-called sanctuary cities, we learned just today it's not going to be taken up in the Senate. So that is another one of these assembly bills that is essentially dead now. There was another piece of legislation that was being protested that would make it harder to issue state IDs to undocumented immigrants. That bill has been passed by both the Senate and the Assembly, is going to Governor Walker. But, you know, in another way, the purpose of the rally is also to just sort of to push back on rhetoric of sort of the Trump campaign and other political campaigns that are sort of hard line on illegal immigration or even just simply anti-immigrant. And I think, you know, there was a lot of people at that rally. I saw it remarked how much larger this rally was than a similar rally just a few years ago. And it is the case that that Latinos are a growing population group in Wisconsin.
We'll leave it there for now. Rob, thanks as always.
All right. Thanks so much.
That's state news editor Robert Mentzer with USA Today Network Wisconsin helping us recap the top stories from around the state this week. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
It's a time for Wisconsin Life. All this week, we've been looking at literacy here in the state. When Renee Reek fell on hard times, her longtime friend Rick stepped in to help her make a new start in Madison. They tell us here about their friendship and the computer skills Renee learned that helped her get her first job in decades.
Well, I live right across the street, so I knew the place was here. So I came in one day to find out what they offered, and come to find out, within like a month or so, they told me they were starting a scale class, and that is for anybody that wants to attend. And it's like, what I like about it is that it helps each person grow in the areas that they want to grow in. My goals were to increase my typing speed, to update my computer skills, and to update my resume. So those were a few of them, the things that I wanted to do.
You know, we were, quite frankly, she was sitting around waiting for SSDI. And I just said, hey, you know, you're better than that. You know, and that might never come. So you just can't do that. And she took it. She went forward with the help of this place. And I believe we just kind of walked in here. Like we walked in here cold.
Well, I met Rick when I was 18, and we dated for a year or two on and off. And then after that, we just stayed really good friends.
Yeah, I mean, I went to UW-Madison, and then her life kind of went in a different direction due to substance abuse issues, and things kind of spiraled out of control, but she's definitely improved with the help of the Literacy Network, helping her get her foot in the door. So it was really kind of a godsend.
You know, a lot of programs and schooling is geared more towards the younger generation, which I'm glad they have that for them. But there's also a lot of people, you know, that are older that for various reasons just need a little help to go forward, you know. That, and it feels good that people, society hasn't given up on you. Coming here, you know, boosted me for what I needed to do, and helped make me feel like I could do something again. Rick's been very supportive and encouraging all my life, and even through the ups and downs that I had. And so all I can do now is try to move forward. Don't just sit around and be depressed about things that you can't change. Just maybe go out and find something that makes you feel better about yourself, and things will change.
Madison's Renee Reek sharpened her computer skills with the support of her longtime friend Rick. They shared their story as part of this week's look at literacy in Wisconsin.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. You can find more online at wisconsinlife.org.
Joining us now to talk about literacy tutoring efforts in our state is Ellen Hossman, Executive Director at Literacy Council of Greene County. Ellen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having us.
Well, why is this work? I understand you're an executive director and a tutor yourself. Why is this work important to you?
If we can empower one other human being to better their lives, that's the importance of literacy. When we can see that they're making great strides, speaking with their employers and their supervisors and teachers at the clinic, we've done our job. It's just very satisfying.
Well, talk about what you're doing as the executive director to pull things together and make this happen.
So our students come to us on their own. We don't go out and look for students in Greene County. They fill out an application at the Monroe Public Library, which is right downtown in Monroe. And then I pick those up and I make a contact with the student. I sit down and I talk to them to get to know them a little bit. If we need a translator, I find someone within our community to help me with translation so that they understand what I'm saying. I'm not fluent in Spanish. So then I, you know, it's what are their interests, what are their goals, and then we do an informal assessment as to where their skills are at. And then I match them with tutors who have been through our training program through the Literacy Council.
And we wanted to get into that role of the tutor. So what's involved in being a literacy tutor?
Well, they have to have a desire to help others. They have to have a sense of humor and a lot of patience. They go through a tutor orientation that I conduct myself, and then we do a tutor orientation, which is about 8 to 9 hours of helping them figure out the curriculums that we have in place, which one they're comfortable using. Our tutors have to have a comfort zone on what they're teaching. Many of our tutors are retired, come from all walks of life, but it's, you know, we haven't been in the teaching realm for many years, so it's just like, well, this is how we would go about helping our children learn to read. So oftentimes we have to start at the very beginning.
Well, and when you started as a tutor, was it the first time you sat down with a student? Was it a little intimidating trying to figure out how to start, where to go with it?
Intimidating, I think, is the right word. It's scary and you're nervous because you don't want to goof up and say something wrong in the English language because you're trying to teach it. And you just have to learn to laugh at your own mistakes. And, you know, our students laugh with us right along the way. So they're as nervous as a first-time tutor as the tutor is themselves.
Talking to Ellen Hossman. She's executive director at Literacy Council of Green Bay, looking at literacy tutoring, the role of the tutor itself. So, Ellen, that's the sort of the nervous side at the beginning. What have you gotten out of it? What have you valued in being a tutor?
Oh, my goodness. The friendships that I have created with the students that I tutor myself, and I see that with all of the tutors within our program here in Greene County, they become more than a tutor teacher. They become a friend, and they, you know, you share the ups and downs of everyone's life and you know, their children's accomplishments. And when you see a student reach their goal of getting their GED and planning on going on to technical school, I mean, it's just so heart fulfilling when you know you've had a little bit of a play in that, okay, I've helped this person better their lives. I was with a student and a tutor this afternoon, and the student told me she no longer has to use the interpreting services at the clinic here in town. And that's huge for anyone who did not speak English 6 years ago.
That's got to be amazing. Yeah, you've got all these milestones, big and probably little triumphs too, like that. And do you see that sense of pride on the student when they share that story with you?
Oh, definitely. Or when they can write a sentence, you know, and it makes sense to them and it makes sense to the person who can read it. They're very proud of themselves because they have done it themselves. We've given them the tools to do that, but we're not putting the words into their brains. We're just helping them find them.
Speaking of finding them, are you able to find tutors fairly easily, or are you always kind of out and recruiting?
You know, it gets to be word of mouth. People hear about our program maybe from another tutor, a friend. The students are some of our best advocates because it's like, well, we learned it from, you know, the Literacy Council. And so we have... We will be doing a tutor orientation within the next couple weeks. We have 6 interested adults, and we always want to sit down with them and explain the time commitment on this. There's many volunteer opportunities out there. But this is one of the most time intense because the tutors meet with the students once a week and for an hour to an hour and a half. And that's a lot of time commitment as a volunteer. And so we haven't had too much of a problem since I've been with the council on getting new tutors into our program.
And how long does the relationship usually last between the teacher, the tutor, and the student? How long do they work together?
We've had some students in our program for 7 years who came to us with absolutely no English. I would say the majority of our students who leave the program only do it because of life changes, that they're maybe working two jobs now or they've moved out of the area. They don't leave because they're not getting the education they need. So on an average with the tutors that we have right now, it's about 5 years.
And Ellen, very briefly as we wrap up, can you give a quick pep talk to somebody who's thinking, hey, yeah, maybe I could be a tutor?
You know, if you want to have fun with another person who doesn't know your language well or can't read English well, volunteering for any literacy program in the state of Wisconsin will certainly give you that opportunity.
Well, Ellen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking to Ellen Hossman. She's Executive Director at Literacy Council of Greene County.
I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for today for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
A recent survey shows that mobile communications like texts and phone calls can play a huge role in relationship satisfaction, even for couples that live close to one another.
There's been research already on the role of mobile technology for long-distance relationships. Makes sense, but what about the rest of us?
It turns out that high-quality communication leads to people reporting higher satisfaction in their relationships, and there are a few reasons for that.
Joining us now to tell us more about her research is Catalina Toma, Assistant Professor of Communication Arts at UW-Madison. Catalina, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So give us the basics. What did you learn? These are people, you know, in proximity. They're dating in the same town or maybe a couple in the same place. What do we know about how their smartphones and other technologies helping them get along?
As you mentioned earlier, Rob, there's a lot of research on the use of mobile technology within long-distance relationships because those relationships depend for their existence almost on this technology. But we know very little about how much co-located couples use this technology and to what effects. So the goal of our study was twofold. First, we were interested in finding out how much dating couples use technology to stay in touch with one another when they're co-located. And secondly, to what extent this usage affects their relationship quality. And it's important to note that in the study, we simply focused on college-aged dating couples, so young folks in dating relationships, not marital or longer-term relationships.
And so how did people who responded to your survey determine if their communication was high quality, or how did you determine if it was high quality?
Luckily, as psychologists, we have scales for those things. We administered a scale asking participants how satisfied and they found their mobile communication to be, how rewarding they found their interactions, and so on and so forth. We also, I should say, measured their quantity of communication. We were interested in both of these indices, quantity and quality of communication, using a variety of media just to ascertain what the patterns are. And we found that mobile communication, so texting first and foremost, and the phone, so voice calling, were by far the most widely used media. Everything else was not so used. On average, our couples used about three distinct media to stay in touch with their partners, despite being geographically co-located, as I mentioned earlier.
I could see an argument either way here. I could see, okay, talking in person is the best way to go. All this other stuff is like, it's like a barrier between you. It's going to be bad communication. Get together more, put away the phones. Or I could see any communication is better. And so the more you're in touch with each other in whatever medium, the better things are. So what did you find?
I would definitely reject the first perspective,
okay.
The idea that mediated communication is in some ways inferior to face-to-face communication.
Well, a little bit.
Or that, not necessarily, because in many situations you're not able to opt for face-to-face mm-hmm. communication, even if you would want to. So mobile communication presents an option to supplement your face-to-face interaction that you wouldn't have otherwise. Think about being separated by work or school commitments for the majority of the time. If you didn't have the phone or texting, you might not be in touch with your partner at all. That's one argument. The other is that there's a lot of research showing that when it comes to communication, less is more. So what we call reduced cue media, so media that obstruct nonverbal cues like texting and to a lesser degree the phone, present advantages when we don't have these nonverbal cues, when we don't have full information about what our partner is up to, how they're maybe gesticulating or what their facial expressiveness is. We have a lot of space to imagine, to project things, and that's not necessarily bad. In fact, in our work, we're finding that the usage of these technology is correlated with partner idealization. So it's allowing us to form an idealized, embellished version of our partner that maybe we wouldn't be able to form face-to-face. Mm. And guess what? Idealization actually is a positive thing in relationships in terms of boosting relational satisfaction. If we didn't think our partner was more special or more wonderful than they probably actually are, we wouldn't be quite so satisfied in our relationships.
So you're saying, I think, that we can basically project onto that text or that link that our partner shared on our Facebook page with us, that we can see that in the best possible light that makes us feel good about ourselves by feeling good about how they feel about us.
Exactly right. So it's a motivated distortion. We see what we want to see, and we want to see positive things in our relationships.
Now, in the workplace, sometimes people worry that, that email, unless you put the smiley face in or whatever, am I supposed to read this as friendly or sarcastic or curt? But I guess in a relationship, people are putting, they're not worried about that stuff. They're reading in the best possible light, so maybe it's not doing potential damage.
Yes, people do read in the direction of their expectations, and within these relationships, we would imagine those expectations to be positive. But also, there's a track record of communication, so you kind of know what to expect. You kind of know how to interpret a partner's more idiosyncratic expressions, maybe. But you're right, there's research showing that things like sarcasm don't translate quite so well in reduced cue environments, because facial expressiveness and gestures and the like are actually important for conveying sarcasm. And when you lose those, you might not be able to convey it quite so successfully.
It would also seem like when you're getting something from your partner, someone who you have spent a lot of time, presumably, in person, you have more context anyway. You're not kind of going blind like you might be with someone who works three departments away from you.
Absolutely right.
So your survey specifically looked at college students. So some of the data might be a little skewed by that demographic. But in that study, what were the most popular ways of communicating?
By far, the most popular way of communicating was texting. Almost 100% of our sample used texting to stay in touch with their partner, and they did so to a substantial degree, about 60 minutes a day, they estimated. And granted, it's kind of hard to estimate how much you text, but our participants estimate about an hour a day. It was followed by the phone, with maybe 3/4 of our participants using it for about half an hour a day on average. Everything else was much less frequently used. I think instant messenger was used by about half of our sample, and everything else much less so. So texting is winning by a long shot.
Now that's with, again, college-age students. Would you anticipate something different with different age groups?
Yes, there's one other study that's looked into the topic and also addressed marital relationships. We're finding texting to be also quite popular, but email was also much more popular with older folks, suggesting that ingrained patterns of use matter. So if you're maybe growing up or being really used to email or instant messenger, some of the older new media, right? you may be using those more for your communication, but if you're growing up with texting, That's quite prevalent.
Talking to Catalina Toma, communications arts professor at UW-Madison, about relationships and our smartphones, our high-tech mobile communications. They are good, is the short version. Using texting and messaging seems to boost how much couples appreciate one another. Now, I don't know if we are knowing what is being texted here, because 60 minutes a day, that's more than pick up some milk. Hopefully it's more than I love you more, no, I love you more. Like, do we have a sense of what is good? Are these just like conversations?
That's a fantastic question, and we really, really badly wanted to investigate the content of communication, but we were unable
privacy,
to do so.
Yeah,
because
be
of
tough.
Private issues, we weren't allowed to collect that data. But we could imagine there's a lot of coordination of tasks, maybe, but also displays of affection and emotional communication as well.
I have to say, texting... I will share things by texting that would never rise to the level of making a phone call or remembering long enough until I get home. So I feel like in some ways, texting or those other really instantaneous communications allow more of kind of a glimpse into my everyday life when I'm away from home.
That's such a good point. And texting has many advantages in that it's very low in cost to produce, right? You can text right away. You don't have to think very deeply about it. It doesn't take long to write out your message. It's also not intrusive, right? You're not interrupting your partner's activities and forcing them to respond in the same way that a phone call would. Responding also is low in cost and tends to happen really quickly. Research shows that many texts are answered within an hour or so, and very often they allow for instantaneous communication, even though that's not mandatory, but people opt to respond really quickly.
And we surveyed some of our colleagues here at WPR, a little older than the demographic you were surveying, Catalina, but Judith, different Judith, said she's married to an avid tweeter, and she says, we're never at a loss for a conversation starter, like, I saw you had a Reuben sandwich for lunch today. But that, I hadn't thought of it that way. It's not just we're texting or we're seeing what each other's doing on Facebook and Twitter, but that's like an instant starting point for when you're together later. So these can feed off of each other.
That's such an interesting insight, and we'd love to do some research on that in the future. People do tend to capture everyday moments on Twitter or Facebook and to think about them and maybe process them in a way that they wouldn't have otherwise. Maybe they would have been forgotten little moments, but because they're posted on social media, they can be conversation starters. And nowadays, people do not feel creepy or weird for following what their friends and family members post on social media. And those arise as subjects of conversation in everyday life. Quite easily.
So you did actually look at how couples present themselves on Facebook, and it can relate to the length of a relationship. What did you find there?
Oh, yeah, that's a different study that was really nice, I think. In that study, we were interested in the extent to which couples' self-presentation as a couple on Facebook was related perhaps to the longevity of their relationship. And again, we studied dating couples in college. And we found that the more couples presented themselves as such, so the extent to which they listed themselves in a relationship and posted joint photographs and wrote on each other's wall, the more committed they felt to their partner. And after 6 months, we actually tracked them longitudinally over time, the more likely they were to stay together with their partner.
So it's another, I mean, there's, you know, promise rings they used to have, an engagement and marriage. And this is a level of commitment, not a necessarily binding one, but a significant one you found.
Yes, yes. Facebook, becoming Facebook official is nowadays an important relational step, an important thing to be negotiated amongst couples. And it's psychologically significant because it does demonstrate public commitment. Facebook is quite a public medium. Our couples had many friends in common. I think we're talking about hundreds or so. So you're displaying your connectivity to this person in front of many people who are meaningful to you. And that in turn, at least we're theorizing so, can make people internalize their belongingness into this couple. So it's psychologically more salient. You're becoming more committed to your partner.
We're talking now to Catalina Toma from UW-Madison about the growing role of mobile communication and social media in our relationships. And we want to hear from you.
How do you use phone calls, texts, or apps to stay in touch with your significant other? Do you think it makes your relationship better or worse? And do social networks like Facebook affect your relationship? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can leave us a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation now on the role of mobile communication in relationships, and we want to hear from you.
Yeah, you can give us some data, your personal experiences at 800-642-1234. There's you. There's your significant other, and you're not together. Do you stay in touch? Do you call each other the old-fashioned way? Do you text? Is there an app? Are you Snapchatting each other? Do you follow each other at Twitter and Facebook and keep tabs on what you're up to, let each other know? And does it make your relationship better? Do you feel like you're more connected, more in touch, and you appreciate your significant other maybe a little more, as we found in this research we're talking about? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Talking about her research on this topic is Catalina Toma, Assistant Professor of Communication Arts at UW-Madison. And we were talking about things like when you declare that you're a Facebook couple. I also, I definitely notice when I know someone's in a couple and they always refer to me or my house or my kids, and I know that they're in a couple, and it makes me pause because I think, huh, that's interesting. They're almost differentiating themselves as an individual. Is that maybe a sign of trouble?
Oh, that's, I versus we?
I versus we,
oh,
yeah.
Okay.
And me and my instead of ours, huh. And us.
That's hard to say. I know of research that's showing that couples who use we communication tend to be more satisfied. So the usage of this communication, of this sort of language, more inclusive language, tends to be associated with relational satisfaction. But personally, I wouldn't view it as a problem. At the end of the day, your Facebook profile is still your Facebook profile. And if you intertwine yourself too much with your partner, that might not be psychologically positive after all.
Although I do have seen married couples that have one Facebook profile and you're never quite sure who's liking or commenting on your things.
That seems a little maybe too intertwined. So yeah, probably some benefit to having that separate identity. So we heard, we asked again some of our colleagues how they do this, how they use mobile communication to stay in touch. We heard from Susanna, one of our co-workers on the floor here. She says she and her partner only have dumb phones. They rarely use text. They don't need that kind of constant communication. Now, I wonder, and I know you focus on college students here, if we're going to see a lot of a generational variation where older generations didn't grow up with this stuff, as you were saying earlier, Catalina. They don't feel that need for contact. Younger generations, they're used to it. They do want that.
I think that's absolutely right. There's a generational difference in terms of patterns of technology use, but there's also psychological differences between dating relationships and longer-term marital relationships. In dating relationships, uncertainty tends to be higher, passion tends to be higher, right? The need for connectedness tends to be higher, whereas in longer-term marital relationships, there's more of a pattern of communication that's been established, and the need for constant contact might be significantly decreased.
And we also had another one of our coworkers, Jeffrey, who said he and his wife embraced mobile phones once they had their first daughter, and if it wasn't for having kids, he thinks they might not have had cell phones at all.
That's interesting. I can see how having a child provides a lot of fodder for conversation and many moments that you'd like to share with your partner.
Well, and I also wonder if it's partly logistics.
Yeah.
and also maybe things that you want to communicate that you don't necessarily want the kids to hear. So maybe you're texting it to each other instead.
That's an excellent point.
There was a range of how much the couples you studied used social media and texting and all that to communicate. What was the high end of the range? Were there outliers that were really on all the time?
There were outliers. The data with respect to texting, at least, was quite skewed. I don't know what the outliers were in particular, but I can tell you that the average number of minutes that the couples reported spending texting with each other was 2 hours, but the data was not distributed in a bell-shaped, in a nice normal distribution. When we took away those outliers, the median value was about 60 minutes. So there were heavy texters, basically. I just don't know what the numbers were.
Okay.
And I wonder, too, you know, there. The element, I mean, we're talking about relationships and satisfaction in relationships. Of course, some relationships are not as healthy as others. And it seems like this ability to be constantly connected can actually feed into possessiveness and jealousy and maybe even abusive behaviors, too. Is there anything that you've seen that shows that this type of immediate communication and expecting immediate response can also have kind of a darker side to it?
That's a really great point. We were not able to look at this in our study, but there's other work on, for instance, attachment styles and mobile communication. And attachment styles refer to the way you view relationships and the pattern of maybe clinginess or avoidance that you demonstrate towards your partner. And at least individuals with a preoccupied attachment style, so those who are constantly worried about not having sufficient connectedness, not being loved enough, and feeling particularly clingy, they do tend to resort to the media quite a bit within relationships, and that can be overwhelming, can be too much. So in this case, the media doesn't cause dissatisfaction, it just allows these individuals with a particular attachment style to manifest themselves, to manifest their unhealthy urges.
We're talking about smartphones, social media, relationships, and connectedness with Catalina Toma. We'll bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Paul joins us in La Crosse. Paul, hi.
Hi. So I met my wife about 10 years ago, and we were communicating through instant messaging. And after a year's time, I moved over. I came over to visit from England, and then, you know, we met face-to-face, and then after a while, you know, 7 years goes by, we communicate through instant messaging and through writing and, you know, whether it's emails or whatever, and we learned more about each other through doing that than we think by actually having a face-to-face conversation, because we were forced to. We had no choice. We were about 3,000 miles apart, so. And then after a while, we became, you know, obviously we're friends on Facebook, and then we got married. And now we're still married, but we're friends on Facebook, and she won't release that status symbol because I want to get rid of Facebook, and she won't let me.
That's that marker. And can I ask, you met long distance, if I could ask, what venue, what kind of site, what were you doing online where you met her?
Well, I guess I was studying in school, like when I was about 18, and playing poker online. On the same table, and we were talking through that.
And you took a gamble, Paul. Thank you so much for sharing. Let's say you met online in online poker. A lot of what we're talking about, all in that one story. But at the end there, she wants him to keep that Facebook profile up so that they can advertise that marital status on social media, Catalina.
That's consistent with our data. People do want to make those public commitments. A wedding ring is a similar concept, right?
Mm-hmm.
And let's go back to the phones, and Kevin is in Gainesville. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. Well, my wife and I are well over our mid-40s. In fact, I'm in my 50s. We've been married almost 10 years. We are not on any social media. We text each other, only emergency contacts, because we really want to be able to talk about our day face-to-face at the end of the day.
So you're actually avoiding that kind of connection to make it more meaningful when you do see each other.
Exactly.
Catalina, what would you say about that? Is that partly a generational expectation or preference, maybe?
It could be. I mean, everybody has their own preferences. The data that we're finding is about patterns of groups of individuals, mm-hmm. right? So on average, this is not a common preference. It'd be an outlier, at least if it's part of our data, but to each their own.
So it's interesting because you look at satisfaction. What if one part of the couple is really satisfied with being in touch all the time? That doesn't necessarily mean that the person they're with gets the same level of satisfaction.
That's a really important point. So the availability of these technological tools is really great in many ways, But it also forces people to negotiate aspects of the relationship that they wouldn't otherwise have to negotiate. And sometimes that process of negotiation is easy when partners are on the same page and have the same preferences, but that's not always the case. For instance, it could be that one partner wants to be Facebook official and the other one doesn't, which is something that has to be talked about, and a consensus has to be reached one way or the other. So it is something to think about that perhaps we didn't have to think about before.
Catalina, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Catalina Toma, Assistant Professor of Communication Arts at UW-Madison, talking about the growing role of mobile communication in relationships.
I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferrat. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.